It is a near constant anxiety. The flood of digital information has become a deluge. Do a Google search and get 13 pages of results. Multiply that by Twitter, by blogs, by Facebook, then multiply that by your mobile devices, and it can seem all very, well, overwhelming. This overload is not, however, a new human experience. Ann Blair, a professor of history at Harvard, points out that early responses to information overload have not been positive. Take the writers of Ecclesiastes or Seneca or Pliny, and these guys didn't even have laptops. We'll talk to Ann Blair in a moment, but first, what is your solution to the digital deluge? Call us at 800-989-8255. Our email address is talk@npr.org, and you can join the conversation at our website. Go to npr.org and click on Talk of the Nation. Ann Blair is professor of history at Harvard and the author of a new book, Too Much to Know, Managing Scholarly Information Before the Modern Age. She joins us from a studio on Harvard's campus. Ann, nice to have you.
Thanks for having me.
So this is not a new condition. Did it begin with the printed word or maybe before?
It probably began before then, judging from Ecclesiastes, as you mentioned, of making books there is no end, or Seneca's line, too many books is distraction. On the other hand, at the same time, there were also enthusiastic responses toward accumulating knowledge going equally far back. So we've got the Library of Alexandria, which tried to collect all Greek manuscripts that they could get their hands on. Or we have someone like Pliny, whom you mentioned, who was very proud to have collected 20,000 facts from over 2,000 authors in his 38-book Natural History from the first century of the Common Era. So on the one hand, there's nothing new under the sun. And on the other hand, there are some moments of peculiar crisis. And one of them certainly is today. But another one is the one I specialize in studying is the print explosion early modern Europe.
Before we get into the specifics of that, I want to ask you a couple of things. The first one is this. As a people, as humans, do we always react the same way, or have we always reacted the same way over time whenever this explosion of new information surfaces in our environment?
Well, no, of course. I think, first of all, there are personality differences. As I suggested, some people want to shut it out and really just return to a few core elements rather than dealing with the deluge, which is a perfectly reasonable response that we all have probably at some times, too. And other people are enthusiasts and want to just gather it all up insofar as possible and make bigger and bigger books with more and more finding devices and ways of searching those collections. And there are, of course, wide cultural variations in what the purpose of the collection was for. So some of the largest collections, actually, the manuscript Yongle Dadian in 15th century China is really only topped recently as something like 100 million words. It's an anthology of all of all known works that they were printed often, but they were actually made in manuscript copy for the use of the emperor and his court. So it was not designed for circulation.
Now this will lead...
On the other hand...
Go ahead, finish your answer. Finish.
On the other hand, in Europe, the situation that I describe of reference books being published are always published in a commercial environment by printers who hope to make money by selling lots of copies to individual readers, mostly.
Well, my question was going to be, and I think this will lead into what you were initially going to talk about with respect to this not being the first time that we have been here. Have we ever had in our existence anything that is even remotely comparable to the explosion of information that the Internet has brought us?
Well, certainly on the scale of information accumulated, no way, of course.
Okay.
I gather that we have almost accumulated one zettabyte of digital information, and I did not know what that was.
I was going to say, I take it that's a lot.
That's a lot. It's 10 to the 21, 10 with 21 zeros after it.
Oh,
and, of course,
my.
Wikipedia is the one that explains that to me. But in terms of having too much for an individual to master, we've been there before. You know, it doesn't really matter with those Google hits if there are 13 pages or hundreds of thousands of pages of hits, because you're really only going to look at the first couple anyway.
That's a good point.
And in that sense, in the 16th century, they really had the sense that there were more books than any one person could master, and then they needed shortcuts, basically.
Now, let's talk about what some of those shortcuts were, and then we're going to open up the phones and we're going to talk to Adam from Minneapolis. Overload has triggered some very practical solutions dealing with sorting, locating, selection, haven't they, over the years?
Absolutely. And so I would call reference books the general category of tools that have been around a long time. Some of them predated the printing revolution, but printing certainly made a much broader range of people familiar with what we use still today, alphabetical indexing, for example, outlining detailed tables of contents, and books that collect what they called the best bits of all those books you won't have time to read yourself. So some of these are in genres that are now dead, like the Florilegium, although Bartlett's famous quotations is basically a kind of Florilegium. It's a collection of quotables, of quotations by authoritative people, that it will be sorted by subject heading. So when you wanted an example or a quotation to put into your composition, whether your conversation or your sermon or a letter or a lecture, you could go to such a reference book, look under the heading that was likely to be useful, and choose a couple of items. So these come in different scales. There are smaller ones for, less expensively available, and there are huge ones accumulating up to 10 million words in this one Magnum Theatrum of 1631, for example.
So you just have to chop the tree down piecemeal in order to see what it is you're dealing with, as opposed to trying to absorb the entire thing right in front of you.
That's right. And you go in with a focus. You go in with something you want to pull out of this. And so that's why you need to understand what the subject heading terms are under which the work is organized, or the index subject headings, so that you can find something you want. And of course, the author and the printers of these works are eager for you to find what you want, and they're constantly boasting, "We have something here for everyone, for every interest." And they offer more and more different indexes with more and more different search terms in order to make sure that you don't come out empty-handed.
Why don't we take a call? Let's go to Adam from Minneapolis, Minnesota. Adam, welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Thank you.
You have a question?
Actually, I was just more of a comment. I really think this is an interesting subject, and it's sort of like watching an old medium be pushed aside. Like, one way that I like to deal with it, like getting away from the internet and Twitters and Reddits and Facebooks of the digital age, is just to kind of like read a book that I've read a million times, or find a smaller medium for the actual media than having to Google it. I mean, I love reading Wikipedia about movies that I've watched and finding out little secrets about authors and stories behind the actual media, but I think it's important to separate yourself because books are an invaluable resource, and a lot of people that I know personally, you know, will turn to their e-readers or their Droid phones before they'll pick up a book and reference something in it. So I think that's really important.
Adam, thank you very much for the call. Are we seeing, are we not sort of an evolution then in the process of culling information and how we do it?
Absolutely. We're relying more and more on computers to do it. But I'd argue that we really need, as Adam was suggesting, to use our own minds to do it. Whether you're, you know, mainly reading from a physical book or from an e-reader, the key thing is to keep your own center of focus and attention so that you can come out with something that's good for you. Of course, we all also derive pleasure and sometimes benefit from just sort of following the lead of a web page. But I think you need to do both.
All right, let's take another call. This is Sean from Cincinnati, Ohio. Sean, welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I got a quick question. Basically, you know, this subject of having so much information out there, I find sometimes if I'm researching a subject or an issue that pertains to my life, I'm overwhelmed with just the amount of different, whether it be quote-unquote facts or opinions. I can basically search for any answer I want, and I'll find, you know, for example, is coffee good for me? You can search, you know, coffee is good for you, or you can search coffee is bad for you, you know, and you'll get positive answers on each side of the spectrum. My question is, how do you filter all these different, quote unquote, whether they be facts or opinions, and run that through a filter so you can basically get a good idea of how to solve a problem, or you know, form an opinion of your own.
Sean, thank you very much for that. That's an interesting question, and it's almost one of accuracy versus quantity, huh?
Absolutely. That question's been around from the very beginning, and in the early modern period, the pedagogues would teach what they called judicium, judgment. That's what you want to impart to every child, and you train them by having them read the good stuff so that when they come across the bad stuff, they'll have the judgment to tell the difference. And I suppose we are constantly doing that ourselves. As an educator, I think that contact with teachers and, of course, parents and is invaluable in helping form judgment about what's a reasonable answer, what's the kind of question you can expect to get an easy answer on. Many questions have very nuanced answers, and you need to have the nuance and both sides of the issue be present in your mind, even as you might, you know, go forward with a preference. So I think, you know, old-fashioned methods of education still must count for a lot. And, of course, there are websites and websites, and so you need to have the skills to evaluate the context of what you're reading, where it's coming from, who's made the website, what's their purpose in doing, you know, in pushing this line.
I want to explore this with you a little bit deeper, if I may. And the reason is, as a journalist, we are taught that, you know, you get at least three sources before to verify something. And the Internet has now made it, as our callers have indicated, and as you have as well, that that may or may not be sufficient anymore because it depends on which three sources you may get. Are you able to offer to our listeners, people who are trying to figure out how they can personally begin to sort through this mountain of information? And you're doing it in part already, but what are some of the specific kinds of things that we should do or can do as we are trying to get from point A to point B without being inundated with information that we can't determine the veracity of it or it's more than we can handle?
Right. So personally, I tend to go for my library's website, which has access to, you know, certain, basically their reference works that are online that have, and of course, being an academic, these would bear on the issues that I teach about, like science and religion or the history of early modern Europe. But there will be good reference books on just about any topic. Many of these reference books are likely to be online. So I think one thing you can do, even without access to a, you know, sort of proprietary content, which Harvard University gives its faculty and students access to, is to look at a library catalog like Harvard's, which is open to the public, and become aware of the major sources, print sources, that then you can Google Books and find on Google Books, find online.
All right.
But you have that way an independent filter, which isn't just the Google alchemical algorithm that feeds you top hits, although, hey, I use Google a lot, have a cross-cutting analysis by using some of the more traditional tools, too.
All right, let's take another call. This one is from Terry in Salt Lake City. Hello, Terry. You're on Talk of the Nation.
Hi. I just wanted to mention the problem with the so-called information overload, where it's just a person at their PC or a researcher even, is you need to cut down, obviously, the number of results. And in order to do that well, you have to understand, to some extent, the software you're using, like Google and so forth. How does their search engine function? What does it look for? And once you understand the way it works, you can fine-tune your inquiry so that you get a lot less dross with your answers. You know, instead of maybe 20 pages, you might only get two. But you have to refine it the right way, because if you refine it the wrong way, you don't find what you want. So you kind of have to understand the stuff you're working with, the technical stuff, a little bit in order to find the information you want without getting overloaded.
Terry, thank you very much for the call. His call reminds me, Ann, of something I hear people saying a lot. What did we do before computers? How did we handle this? And you've talked a little bit about it, but give us a sense once again from a historical perspective how people managed to sift through information before the digital age.
Well, they, I think, took advice about what to read from teachers, for example, from other peers and colleagues. And, of course, I still am a firm believer in personal contact. I get a lot of my best references from people who know what I'm working on and will have suggestions for me. And then they would take notes. So I'm a big fan of note-taking myself, too. And this how to take notes is one of the things that teachers really published about for the first time in the 16th century. It's about recording what you found best in what you read so you can find it again. And so you don't have to research Google all the time. So you can return to things that you have valued. And, of course, you hope to keep them in memory, but in practice you won't keep all of them in memory. And that's where the note-taking techniques that they taught are still, I think, of value today by assigning a heading under which you hope to retrieve this information again. So now I take notes on computer mainly. Of course, in their time, they took notes on sheets of paper in ink. Then we went through the index card, which is still very much in use today and makes for a sort of a smaller and more mobile, medium for note-taking.
You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Time is running really short, but this is a question that a caller has. I want to see if we can squeeze them in before we have to say goodbye. Casey, you're on from Los Angeles. Casey? Oh, we lost Casey. Well, I'll tell you what Casey had called about. Casey wanted to know, he says, I'm not sure if it was a he or she, actually, that this is a generational issue and that this person, Casey, being young, I'm assuming, is not overloaded. We don't have much time, so I need as succinct an answer as you can give me, that this doesn't bother this person. It's only us old people that have trouble with this.
Well, maybe she'll get old, too, and become bothered by it. I think... When you start having specific goals you want to accomplish, then, that professional focus tends to make you feel more uncertain about, have you done enough to be able to go forward? When is enough research and when is too much?
The other question that this raises is we have gone through these cycles of explosions of information, which suggests to me, and I'm asking you, are we yet to see an even bigger one in the future?
I would bet so. How can it be less?
How can it not be? If history yeah. does repeat itself, doesn't it? Anne, thank you so much. Anne Blair, a professor of history at Harvard University, the author of a new book, Too Much to Know, Managing Scholarly Information Before the Modern Age. She joins us from a studio at Harvard University. You can find a link to her article on our website. Just go to npr.org and click on Talk of the Nation. Anne, once again, thank you for coming on.
Thank you.
This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm Tony Cox, sitting in for Neil Conan. We'll see you tomorrow.